This is Fresh Air. The full Senate began debate today on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. It looks like he will easily get the majority vote. If the Senate confirms Thomas, he will be the first Supreme Court justice to be confirmed without the recommendation of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Some people are saying it's time to reform the confirmation process. We invited Duke Law Professor Walter Dellinger to give us his critique of the process. Dellinger was surprised at the Judiciary Committee's split vote. He says it's a sign that some of the senators on the committee reevaluated their role as the hearings progressed.
I think as we went into the Thomas nomination, it was assumed that the Senate had to prove that there was something wrong with the nominee in order to justify a rejection. I think the very process of hearings has helped create the assumption that this is a nominee on trial, and therefore, in order to vote no, you must prove, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt that the nominee is guilty of some sort of failing, either personal or in being a dangerous radical. I think towards the end of the process, at least some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee began to ask, why can't we just say that there ought to be a better nominee? Why does there have to be this burden on those who would vote no? Why isn't the burden on the president and his nominee to demonstrate that he or she is a person that would clearly bring distinction to the Supreme Court? And that tended, I think, to shift the vote in the committee fairly dramatically at the end of the process.
Senator Biden has suggested that there be a set of hearings to review the confirmation process. Would you like to see that happen?
I think this is the ideal time after this nomination is over and before the next nomination, and we are certainly likely to have vacancies on this court almost at the rate of one a year for the next couple of years. It's essential that we sit back between confirmation battles and ask whether this process is the process that we ought to have, and can this process be saved, and can it be more satisfactory? So I'm eager to see these hearings take place.
I'm interested in hearing more of your critique of the confirmation process. Let's look at the questioning process during the Senate Judiciary hearings. Several Democratic senators tried to really press Thomas on his views of abortion. Was that appropriate? Thomas resisted giving answers to those questions.
You know, I found this one of the most difficult issues to deal with, and I have really agonized with it in my own mind. And finally, towards the end of this process, came to a final conclusion, and that is this: that a nominee ought to be able to say and discuss any issue that a sitting member of the court would be willing to discuss. And I've reflected on those occasions when justices like Justice Scalia or Justice Blackmun have appeared at Duke Law School and at other campuses and thought about what do they feel free to talk about. And they certainly feel free to talk about what they think about the general proposition of Roe versus Wade. If you ask Justice Scalia whether he thought the 14th Amendment's Liberty Clause protected a woman's fundamental interest in terminating a pregnancy, he would say, no, I don't. And he would say that in public at a law school forum. And Justice Blackmun would say, yes, I do. I believe the right to make reproductive choices is as fundamental a liberty as there is and can't be abridged without a compelling interest. Now, I think Judge Thomas was therefore perfectly free to offer either of those opinions to the Senate. Here's where I would draw the line. If you ask a sitting justice like Scalia or Blackmun, do you believe that the Pennsylvania abortion control law, which has just been invalidated by the district court, is constitutional or not? They would say, I can't answer that question. That is a statute that is being tested in the court, and that case is likely to come before the Supreme Court in the very near future. And I need to wait and see what the briefs and what the arguments are before I make up my mind on that case. So I know this is a fine line, but I think they can discuss their view of whether the Constitution is a general proposition treats a personal decision like continuing or terminating a pregnancy as a fundamental liberty, without discussing a particular state statute to come before the court.
My guest is Walter Dellinger, and he's a professor of law at Duke University. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Dellinger. He's a professor of law at Duke University. Are there questions you would have liked to ask that weren't asked of Thomas?
I think, by and large, the right questions were asked. I think that the hearings process doesn't lend itself, as presently structured, to a very effective dialogue. Each senator has 20 minutes to ask questions. There is a unfortunate tendency of senators to use much of the 20 minutes engaging at what some see as their own preening display of knowledge before in the last minute or two finally getting to a question. So the questioning doesn't occur at very much depth. I look back at the Fortas hearings, Terry, and it was interesting. Each senator questioned the nominee one time for as long as he wished to ask questions. So that Senator Ervin, Sam Ervin, questioned Judge Fortas, he had been nominated for Chief Justice, questioned him for not 20 minutes, but 2.5 days, during which time you can explore a lot of the nominee's views. I guess I would like to have seen more questions that would give us a sense of whether Judge Thomas has had much real legal experience. I think one of the concerns that emerged in the question didn't bring it out is that while he has had a very interesting career, he hasn't had the opportunity to really do much law. That is, he's run a couple of major agencies at quite a young age, the Education Department Civil Rights Office and the EEOC. But what is, in a sense, missing from his biography are years early in his career when he was in the library at night studying cases and statutes. And so he is unfortunately, I think, thinly prepared as compared with other nominees. And more detailed questioning might have given us a better sense of the extent to which that's true.
That leads to the issue, what intellectual and professional distinction should be required for the job of Supreme Court Justice? And how can that best be evaluated by the Senate?
Well, what are we looking for in Supreme Court justices? The first key point is that there is no one model for a good Supreme Court justice. And in fact, you wouldn't want 9 members of the court who had the same kinds of distinctions or the same kinds of backgrounds. Anytime there's a vacancy on the court, you ought to think about what's missing from the court. And there are certainly several things missing. First of all is simple intellectual distinction. I think many believe this is one of the least intellectually distinguished courts we've had in a very long time. Secondly, this court is lacking any member or members who played a prominent role in the public life of the nation before going on the court. Gee, the court in 1954 that decided the Brown versus the Board of Education that ended Jim Crow, every member of that court had played a prominent role in public life. 3 U.S. senators, the most powerful governor of California, Earl Warren, 3 attorneys general. On this court, we have one member who served briefly in a state legislature, Justice O'Connor, and a couple of justices who were number 3 or number 4 down in the Justice Department as assistant attorneys general. But really no one who understands how the nation works, and I think that's a great lack.
If there are hearings on the confirmation process, do you think there should be any new guidelines on the questioning process?
Well, I think one of the most important things that a reexamination of the confirmation process could do is to ask more broadly whether the hearings are serving their proper purpose. We went 125 years in this country with no nominee ever appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Not until 1925 did the first person ever appear. And not really until 1959 did we begin a steady tradition of nominees appearing before the hearing. And I think as a result, in recent years, we've made the hearings too central a part of the process, that the Senate ought to be expected to ask before the hearings whether a nominee is a person of demonstrated high achievement, rather than having senators be expected to prove that out of the nominee's mouth at the hearing.
If up to 1955 there weren't confirmation hearings, with the nominee testifying at the hearings, what were the hearings like?
Well, the hearings were actually just committee meetings at which the nominee's record was reviewed. In the absence of a hearing, it seemed less like a sort of, quote, due process trial, and more like what it is, which is a political decision for the Senate. And during the period when there were no hearings and no nominees appearing, the Senate felt very free to reject really about 25% of all the president's nominations on the basis that their record led the Senate to believe there might be someone better. Now, I think the most important reform we could make in the process would be to engage the Senate in an advice-giving role to the president prior to the president's naming an individual. Now, the Constitution specifically contemplates this. Article 2 provides that the president shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate appoint judges of the Supreme Court. What is missing in the past decade has been a process whereby the president sat down with the Senate. I think if you had that process, if the Senate even put forward publicly some of the names they were suggesting, suppose this time the Senate leadership had suggested after Marshall's resignations names like Dean Guido Calabresi of the Yale Law School or former Secretary Carla Hills, Judge Harry Edwards of the D.C. Circuit, an African-American judge who was one of the most distinguished lawyers and scholars in the United States before he spent 12 years. Then at least the president's nominee would be compared with the, you know, with the kind of people that were not chosen.
You'd like to see the Senate emphasize its advise role more in the confirmation process, as opposed to just the consent role in the advise and consent. If the president nominates the Supreme Court justices, it's possible that the justices will reflect the president's point of view and not be as strong as we might like in providing the checks and balances to the executive power. Is that why you want to see the Senate take a stronger role in the nominating process?
It is. I think what is critically important about the court is whether we will have a group of men and women with life tenure and a judicial tradition who will stand between the state and the individual. That there are many observers of the court who are concerned that the direction of the present court is a direction of judges who are what we call that familiar type, the government judge. Judges who are willing to rule with and go along with the government. Now, the president is certainly entitled to seek judges who will uphold the power of the government and uphold the power of his executive, but it's the role of the Senate to resist that. The framers of the Constitution considered giving the president the power to appoint judges, and they rejected that idea. In fact, the Constitutional Convention in the early drafts overwhelmingly voted to have the Senate exclusively name all judges and to give the president no role at all. Only at the end of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was it decided to give the president some role, that is, the role of nominating. And even then, the principal drafter of that provision, Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania, said that this final article on judicial appointment still gives the principal authority to the Senate. The Senate will choose the justices out of those nominated to them by the president. So we've gotten a very long way from an original understanding that the Senate would play a principal role, and more are deferential to presidential authority.
Well, Walter Dellinger, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts on the confirmation process.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being with you.
Walter Dellinger is a law professor at Duke University. This is Fresh Air.